That means it's.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. So the next presentation is Preserving Language Through Documenting an Endangered Craft, a weaving case study in Ntuku in Solomon Islands. And the presenter is Kim B.V. Wells from Dallas International University.
Thank you, my cheerleaders. Thank you all. If I were to have a secondary title, because not everybody kind of really connects. If we just say the word weaving, everybody automatically assumes I'm talking about weaving. The story is really a lot broader. So consider elicitation through participation, or going deep by doing an apprenticeship. And these are other presenters during the conference that I've been to your various talks, and you have touched on and intersected with this idea that if you take on this side project, there are other things that can happen besides just acquiring the language that's associated with that. So you see some, Michael had the breadfruit and the birds. We have Andrew that got really excited about things that were going on with land, and Laura McPherson, and I'm a music person, so I could really resonate. I can really resonate with her presentation and so forth. You know, for you it might be the talk that I just left, they said traditional ecological knowledge in the program, but when I got there it was actually a lot more specific. It was related to clams. So whatever your rabbit hole is, that's what this is about. And I haven't been to these last two, the forest walks and the cartography, but I'm anticipating that there's going to be this similar idea where you take your personal interests and you go deep in that area, in that particular culture where you're working and serving, and that you can distill a lot of additional knowledge from that. So other people are showing technology, games, bushcraft, other interests that have provided opportunities for working within the group that you're already serving. So consider, the crafts are more about just making things. You can get a lot deeper, more relevant information. And of course, you know you're gonna get language. But what about if you take on a craft and you get that craftsman level vocabulary associated with that? And the values, you discover what's important to that community and why. You discover what people believe, why they believe it, why something is done a certain way and those implications. And of course the relationships that you develop with the people, the relationship of the craft with people, and between the craft and their ethos, beliefs, and so forth. And obviously it's a lot deeper than that, but I've got 20 minutes. So ground zero for this project began with the Nela dance among the Ntuku speakers of Santa Cruz Island. And so as the special projects were being parceled out, looking at it from the perspective of the dance and the ring and the lyrics of the music, the costumes, I sort of, when I was offered something, Brenda assumed that I would jump on music. I took that as a given. I'll do the music, sure, but I can also do this as well. Because years ago, in the periphery of my homebody experience, I learned to weave a long time ago. And I hadn't done it in years, and I had to take that information out, sort of dust it off. But it was useful in this case. So the context was, I was with a group of people with a targeted focus of the Rapid Word Collection Workshop in 2015 on Santa Cruz Island. And I would have put a map, but I was not satisfied with any of the maps that I saw online. Sure, they're nice ones, but I wasn't happy. So when we got to the semantic domain of 6.6.1.4 about weaving cloth, an expert was called in, and in that particular place, it's knowledge and crafts are held by specialists, and it's clan-based. So you have proprietary knowledge among specific groups. So the wood carving clan, it only does the wood carving and they don't do anything else. And the clan that makes these temas, they don't make anything else. And so in this case, we have the weaving clan, and the knowledge is passed from father to oldest son. This gentleman here was the oldest son, and his father told him back when he was a boy, you will learn to weave. And being the respectful son that he was, the Ntugu version of yes, sir. And he wasn't interested in it though. And so he did the bare minimum of what was required of him. And so once he had fulfilled his obligation or duty, he went on to pursue the things that were more interesting to him. But when his father died, he had this epiphany, if I die, this dies with me. I could drop dead of a heart attack or stroke or whatever, and this information dies with me. So immediately he begins to try to revive the knowledge that he had set aside for so long, and he starts recruiting his clansmen to try to generate interest among them. And so by the time I actually got to the island, he had taught five other people to weave. So there were six weavers when I got there. And the concern was, you know, as with any culture, there may be taboos, there may be restrictions. If it's the only this clan and only the men and only firstborn sons, do I look like any of those? So it was a very real possibility that he would say, no, I'm not going to teach you. But because of his experience with the near extinction of his craft, he was willing to share that for the sake of archiving it and preserving it, which was very, very generous as far as I'm concerned. So he taught me to go through the activities and the processes of the banana fiber weaving. And for a month and a half or so I wasn't even doing this for the entire time that we were in Santa Cruz, but I spent a lot of time in their home. And you see in the previous slide, you see Selwyn's wife. Her name is Miriam, and they needed to know always when I would be there, so she would be present, obviously for the appropriateness of having another lady around, having his wife around, and so forth. So considering that she sacrificed time that would have been spent doing subsistence activities, she sacrificed that for this project. So I have to respectfully acknowledge that. So what came out of this project was a lot of cool information, and what you see up here is by no means complete. These are sample segments that were generated through the research. So we have an instruction manual for processing all the fibers, and that's not just the processes for the yarn is not the right word, but the strands that were used for the weaving, but also tassel fibers and fringe fibers. You have an instruction manual for weaving banana fibers on the backstrap loom. So what are the processes of warping that loom? And for him, it's very step by step, probably culturally kind of ritualistic, because it needs to be done in a particular sequence for it to work properly. Documenting traditional designs. Early 20th century, there was an awful plague that came through the island, and a lot of local knowledge was lost. Approximately 90% of cultural knowledge was lost. Population was lost. And imagine the cultural knowledge that was lost along with that many people dying in a very short time frame. So when I would ask him about different designs, he'd say, I don't know. And so that was, he became painfully aware of the gaps in his own knowledge. So we have a certain amount of trees. In the time since this was done, we've discovered that there are a lot more trees that are suitable. Tree is the word they use. We understand botanically it's actually a plant, but locally it's referred to as a tree, so I'm going to use it that way out of habit. But the trees that are suitable for harvesting fibers useful for materials and the designs, and of course the loom itself and the processes for that. So there are verbs for the different actions that are taken. And so I acquired the charter myth. As a matter of fact, when I first, my very first day there, his English was not as good as I thought it was, but he handed me some print version of the story, and he wanted me to read this part right here. So basically it was the charter myth on how weaving came to Santa Cruz Island with this loom. And so, obviously the language data, you have all of these craftsman level words that were, some were already in the dictionary, but many were not. And some have no English equivalent at all. And so that was pretty exciting to discover different actions and things like that. We do the same processes, but we may not have a word that denotes that. So what happened in the community? There was a lot of excitement and revitalization of not just the language, because that's a different talk, somebody else's talk. But he gave us access to lots of pictures that had been given to him, that he kind of self-designated himself as a curator of cultural knowledge, because he was just so aware of how endangered this information was. And so he was willing to share that. And so in that stack of information was this picture on the left of this this bag, basket, from 100 years ago. And so what happened was I had asked him to make a garment for me. It's called a lepanesa. It's a breech clout. You have a flap in the front. It goes through the crotch. It's folded over belts and things. And then it hangs in the back. And it actually has a lot of coverage, but I can't imagine it being too comfortable. And anyway, I had neglected to take some still shots of one little step in that process. So I asked him, will you please make me a basket with this fringe? And he gave this kind of look, I'm not sure I can do that. In his mind, you can see it in his eyes. I'm not sure about that. But he didn't want to tell me no, which I appreciate. And he did his best, because he had already shown me how to do all of these processes. It just looked different on the basket. And when it was done and I went to fetch my basket, he was so excited. He was over the moon because he recognized it as being from this museum, from a picture. He didn't think of it when I was asking him, and he had never made one before. And so he had told me that other people had seen it before me and they were already placing their orders, if you will, because it was a historical style. It was a revived style. And there's a little story about how it got its name, but I don't have a lot of time for that. Other community results, there was an increase in the number of weavers. What was exciting and very exciting to me is on the right, you see these young men. So this is Selwyn's son and nephew, cousin, brother. I'm not completely sure about the kinship relationships, but they see this foreign white woman all up in their father's grill, you know, with camera and videotaping everything that's happening. And they see this outsider interest. And so they approached him and said, would you teach us to weave? And he did. So that was happening while I was there and I didn't know it. And so understanding that here in this photo on the left, you have half of the weavers in one shot. And these two young men that were 18 at the time, they produced this basket that's in the middle picture, and then they sold it for a boat ticket so they could go to town. So I would like to go back when the opportunity is actually possible and measure some revitalization. I would like to go deeper in interviewing each weaver while the numbers are manageable and seeing how that's working in their personal economy, what has done with the patterns and the names, because in the course of this in the course of this community, in the course of the research, while the young men are doing this, the demand for the revived style, Selwyn somewhere in there, he gets an idea. I would love to get all the weavers together in one place. We could have a weaving hut. He's describing what I might think of as a guild. And so he's describing this idea sharing and generating an inventory that they could all manage and discuss techniques and methods and so forth. And so that would be the type of thing I would want to find out. What has happened since then? Because when I went to Kulten in 2017, he came to Honiara and I picked his brain while everybody was out doing cave exploration. I didn't know, this may be the last time I see him. So I asked him every question I could think of. And one thing was, are y'all generating any new patterns? And he's like, no, no new designs. And I'm like, wrong answer. And my next question was, so are you trying to produce these older traditional patterns? And he said, that's what they've been trying to do, is they've taken every picture. And after that experience of retro innovation, they're looking at the pictures with new eyes. They have some confidence to try those things. Hey, if I could do that, maybe if I do this, I can reproduce this traditional design or that traditional design. And so even the ones I don't know names for, we can make this. And so that's what they've concentrated their efforts on. And so, in conclusion, the outsider interest has led to a lot of positive effects when it comes to revitalization for the language and the culture. Language, because I was part of that team, and so we were benefiting from Brenda's long-standing relationships in that community. A researcher can go really deep in a particular area. You can document this endangered craft. For you, it may not be weaving. Maybe it is something else. Maybe it's wood carving or pottery. Maybe you don't consider yourself creative at all, and you may prefer to discover more about what is interesting to you, whether it's shells or fish or trees and so forth. So you have these natural opportunities for elicitation, and of course that provides a context of documentation where that information and knowledge can be conserved. So this is a quote from one of my professors. I think it says it all. Because language doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in a context among humans, and humans do what humans do. So whatever it is that has their interest and your interest, and you see what's important to them, maybe that would inspire you to dig a little deeper and see what happens with that research. Thank you. Questions?
12 minutes for questions.
Oh, awesome. Yes, sir.
Well, for me, as an Austronesian historical linguist, there are several really interesting things about your talk. One of them is that weaving, we've got clear comparative linguistic evidence for backstrap loom weaving going all the way back to Proto-Austronesian, but it's very rare in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
It's found in the Caroline Islands. It was reported, I think, for Santa Cruz by W.H.R. Rivers about the time that 1912 item
right.
was produced. And then it's found in Banks Islands in northern Vanuatu and in three villages, Austronesian-speaking villages in the north coast of New Guinea. Other than that, it's really rare. It's all over the place in island Southeast Asia, and with inherited terminology related to the loom and the batten and so on. The other thing that's really strange about this, I mean, this is a really aberrant Austronesian language. I mean, it's called Austronesian, but my gosh, it's hard to tell. And you've got a very Papuanized culture. I mean, that nose, you know, that septal ornament through the nose, that's
mm-hmm.
just, you don't find that among Austronesian speakers anywhere except in areas where there's been contact with Papuans.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that for men to be doing the weaving, the only other place I know this, I mean, it's always the women in Austronesian speaking societies, the only other place I've ever heard where men do the weaving is among the Hopi in Northeast Arizona,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, really striking. So it's this is fascinating for me. I mean, yeah, I'm sure it's interesting for other people too. It is really.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I do hope so. Another question or comment? It doesn't have to be weaving related. You realize that. I want to make sure that you understand. Yes, Michael.
Thank you.
good point. There is plaiting that happens. There's the type of weaving that we think of as being like this, and it's not done on a loom. And yes, mats, baskets, and so forth. And so that's kind of like community knowledge that just anybody can have. And this is the little niche that's proprietary. But you're right. It's not like weaving as an idea is completely exclusive. It's just the type of weaving. So yes, there are mats and baskets and so forth. But textile weaving, as we understand it, like what I might generate on a loom at home with, say, wool or cotton or linen or so forth, is not done there. Those aren't the fibers that they have to work with. And so I only saw on that island with the loom the banana fibers. But people weren't afraid to use things like hibiscus and other materials for using the other types of plaiting type weaving.
And does the special vocabulary translate across the different domains?
That would be a great separate rabbit hole to explore, because I was hoping to get to do that as well, and it didn't happen. So other things were going on as well. Yes, sir.
The person, that man that taught the weaving, is he still living?
He is, yes, sir. And I look forward to seeing him again to update my information.
And the next question is, what's next for you? Are you going to go back and continue to document and do all the weaving?
I really hope so. That is a plan that I have, and I'm actively, presently pursuing those opportunities. I did apply for a grant that I was not approved for, but I'll just have to try again, you know, with some different funding. Yes, sir.
What was the story behind the name of that basket?
So my custom name, the traditional name that they gave me, was Singer, or more accurately, Singer Woman, because both of my undergrad degrees are in music, and I sing. And so I got used to hearing that word as my name. It's pronounced Inge. And so what the name of that basket became was the Singer Basket. And what's interesting about that, so that's the Bali Sa Inge. And what's punny about that is the dancers are technically not dancers. They think of themselves as singers. And the dance ring is opened and six men go in. So these are the men that are carrying this Singer basket for their betel nut supplies. And they use the Singer basket, but with the woman name, because that was my custom name. Yes, ma'am.
This is really interesting. Thank you so much. It's a tradition that was passed father to oldest son, but now it looks like he's teaching a cousin or something. Is that also in the same clan, or do you see expansion out of clan?
It is in the clan. That's an important point. So the only legitimate carriers of this particular knowledge in that place are the clansmen. So he is trying to recruit his clansmen, understanding that even though this is the traditional way that we've always done it, and maybe we'll eventually do that way again, right now we're in survival mode. We need to get as many weavers in our clan as we can to conserve the knowledge.
Okay, so the father to eldest son thing can be set aside, but not the clan.
Correct. That seemed to be like a stable thing in place, because that is among their values. The proprietary knowledge has to be sustained within the clan. And I get the impression, and I need to have this confirmed, but my theory is there may be the idea that it loses its value in the culture if just anybody can do it, that it needs to be kept within that clan in the local way of thinking. Anyone else?
Another question I do have is on what you just said. I believe that it's really important that we learn all of these skills and learn each other's languages and share, so we don't lose all of these beautiful customs and traditions and beliefs, because it's God's creation, and it's God's language, and it's a beautiful traditional culture and languages. So it's so neat to learn that what you did, you learned somebody else's culture. I think that's really neat.
Thank you very much. My hope is that you'll go into the communities that you work in and find something that's interesting to you and what can be distilled out of that experience. Like I said, maybe you're not crafty. I'm a maker. It could be anything from scrapbooking, stamping, weaving, spinning, sewing. I'm still working on sewing. or making jewelry, you know, other things. I have lots of different interests. So it was easy for me to find something interesting. I don't know about you, but I know that you do other things besides just analyzing micro parts of words. Is it okay if I share what you do? Okay, so Brenda spent her day doing language when she was working on translation projects. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm sick of looking at words. And so she would do scrapbooking, messing with shapes and colors to work the other side of the brain to sort of balance out her mental energy, if you will. But her interests were trees and fish. And so that's not necessarily a creative field, but it generated a lot of data about the values and what's important in that community. Yes, ma'am.
Thanks for your talk. I had just a kind of funny funding question, but you said that the wife of the person had to give up her otherwise working time. Are your grant able to support her financially?
That is an excellent question. At the time, I was under an umbrella with Brenda's Dell grant for documenting endangered languages. And so I think that was a decision that they made. I didn't realize it was happening until later. Now that I'm more sensitive to it, if I return, that's definitely going to be something that I would have to consider in my funding proposals. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Sorry, I missed part of the presentation, but I was wondering when the new basket pattern was revitalized, do you find any language loss or gain from the project?
And that's, we found a lot of new language that was very specific to the craft. And so we were able to gather these words that were nouns for the parts of the looms and names of designs, also actions and segments of the process that had names that were very specific.
Time for maybe one more question.
Anyone else? I'm so excited you all came to have a room full of people that are actually interested in discovery, something in your language that may be thinking about it in a way that you haven't thought about before. Thank you so much. Thank you.